did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill. What did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
He went out tiger hunting with his elephant and gun. In case of accidents, he always took his mom.
He's the all-American bullet-headed Saxon mother's son. Captain Marvel zapped him right between the eyes.
Zap! All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
The children asked him if to kill was not a sin. His mommy butted him.
If looks could kill, it would have been us instead of him.
All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill. Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to What Does a Police State Look Like? You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Schoolcraft recordings were used in a class action lawsuit over stop and frisks in New York. In August, a federal judge ruled against New York City in the case, saying the police department's stop and frisk tactics were unconstitutional. The city has appealed that decision. Schoolcraft recordings were also used in another class action lawsuit about quotas. That case is still ongoing. Schoolcraft himself is suing the department for $50 million. Two officers have come forward to back up his charges, but he remains suspended without pay, living with his dad, 350 miles away in upstate New York, where he says a dozen times, city police have shown up and pounded on his door, yelling, NYPD, we know you're in there. Open up. Of course, he recorded it.
Adrian, we know you're in there. Just open the door, please, so we can get back to New York.
Schoolcraft assumes that he'll never again work as a police officer anywhere. Is it weird not to be a policeman anymore?
It feels odd.
Yeah.
But I still feel like I am a policeman. I'm going forward with this investigation. I just feel like this is my case. This is the one. And I'll go all the way with it.
And finally, with the 81st under new supervision, the numbers on serious crime in the precinct have risen. 10%, which raises the question, is crime going up? Or is that closer to the true amount of crime that was already there that's only now being recorded? Graham Raymond has written a book about Adrian Schoolcraft's recordings. It's called The NYPD Tapes, The Shocking Story of Cops, Cover-Ups, and Courage.
So we're the Lemons, and thank you so much for having us. We've been refraining from the desserts, so we're very excited about that as well. Sometimes we are afraid of change. We want things just to stay the same. We think that we're moving too fast when we say forgive the past. But there's so much to learn from each other. We can only make it together. So give us a smile.
Smile
is forgiving, and now is the time for living. A world of peace, war will cease. I can see you are me in disguise. Let me open up my eyes. A world of peace, war will cease. I can there's a way, but only one way to play the game. Holding on to the dark of night, trying to hold back the incoming light. There's so much to learn from each other. We can only make it together.
Give us a smile.
A smile is forgiving. And now is the time for living. A world of peace, war will cease. I can see you are me in disguise. Let me open up my eyes. A world.
Coming up next, NSA threatens national security. Drew Schneider is interviewed by Scott Horton.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're at scotthorton.org. And our first guest on the show today is Bruce Schneier. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic and chief technology officer of CO3 Systems, a computer security firm. His latest book is Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust That Society Needs to Thrive. That's interesting. Welcome back to the show, Bruce. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show, and very happy to point people toward this article in The Atlantic, How the NSA Threatens National Security. Before we get too far into that, I wanted to ask you real quick, if I could... Now that we're a little bit more than half a year out from the beginning of all the Snowden revelations, For someone like yourself, who is such an expert in computer security issues before anyone ever heard of Edward Snowden, what have you learned from his revelations, if anything? Or what's the most important part of what you've come to understand since the Snowden-Greenwald leaks?
So what we've learned really is the extensiveness of the NSA's operations, both breadth and depth. I mean, in some respects, nothing's really a surprise. If you looked up a cartoon villain of the NSA in the years before, these are the sorts of things you'd expect them to do. But we really didn't realize how extensive their operations were, how much of the internet they eavesdrop on, how many people they eavesdrop on, how much data they collect. And more importantly, we didn't realize how much they're actually subverting the fabric of the internet, how much they are deliberately weakening products and protocols, making it more insecure for everybody so they can eavesdrop. We sort of knew the budget in general terms, but to see details is really a big deal. And I think it's the reality of it, the cold reality of the details, that's most surprising, even though it's really not that surprising, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly knew that they're keeping track of, I mean, I've heard from a very much a layperson point of view still, but I've been keeping track of NSA-type stories since the 1990s, and always just assume that, yeah, they can turn your microphone on if they want to. Yeah, they're keeping track of your triangulation data and whatever, so that they can compare it later. But basically, a lot of what, I mean, and I've read my Bamford and everything, but a lot of what we're talking about, I guess, is sort of just, you know, what people in the know kind of know. They're like, oh yeah, they're way outside the law. They kind of are watching everything. But now we can really see it in their PowerPoint slides. Yep, this is the way we do it, all right. Here it is, all for you, in color, not even in black and white.
And the details make a difference. And really the debate we're having is this the sort of thing we should be doing? I mean, if the Snowden revelations said the NSA was spying on North Korea and the Taliban, nobody would care, right? That's what we want them to do. So they were spying on the G20 and Belgium and the oil company in Brazil, you know, all of these groups that we think, you know, why are they doing this? Right? That they're collecting emails from everybody, cell phone location data from everybody. These sort of bulk collection and collection on nominally our allies that we wonder, is this worth it? And then at the enormous cost of really breaking the trust of the internet, you know, suddenly you look at the agency and say, you know, maybe you've gone a little too far.
Oh, and I'm sorry, Bruce, tell me about what you mean by breaking the trust of the internet.
So fundamentally, we all believe the internet is secure. It's secure for banking. It's secure for commerce. It's secure if you're a Chinese dissident. It's secure if you're doing things that you want to be private. And a lot of people rely on the internet for their lives. It's one thing for the NSA to spy, right? Take the internet as it is and spy on it, but they've gone a step further. They've actually deliberately weakened the products and services everybody uses. So, and when they do that, they're weakening it for everybody. In a lot of ways, the debate has been mischaracterized. A lot of the debate in the United States is, should the NSA be allowed to spy or not? And that, I think, is fundamentally wrong. The real debate is, should we have an internet that is vulnerable to every attacker, or an internet that is secure for all users? You can't get to say NSA spies and no one else can. Either everyone can spy, NSA, China, Russia, other countries, cyber criminals, or nobody can spy.
Right. Because, like you're saying, they're deliberately breaking all the locks. Even there, as we've read in some of these stories, they're bribing the companies to put out broken encryption keys in the first place.
And this is an important point, that once, and they do that, they bribe, they coerce, they threaten, they engage in legal action to get companies to deliberately weaken their products. Once they do that, anybody can exploit the weakness. Right? There's no magic NSA-only weakness. That doesn't exist. You know, they have a secret, but other groups can find out that secret. And as we see, a lot of the techniques that the NSA is using are techniques China uses, are techniques criminal uses. They're not really magical. They're just bigger budget. Mm-hmm. So we have a choice. We can make the internet safe for everybody and secure for everybody, or we can make the internet vulnerable for everybody. And a vulnerable internet is much more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your piece, again, it's how the NSA threatens national security at the Atlantic. You talk also about how we've learned that it's not just the NSA, and I think, I'm not exactly sure the way you wrote it, whether you're referring to what all the NSA is passing on to state and local and other federal agencies, or the ways in which our local police are now just mimicking the NSA and tapping our cell phone locations themselves, or all of the above?
So we're not sure exactly how this works, but it is clear that the FBI is using a lot of the NSA tactics domestically. We don't know if they're developing them independently. We don't know if the NSA is passing along technology or if the NSA is passing along data. We do know the NSA has passed along data to both the IRS and the Drug Enforcement Agency and had them lie about where they got it. This is directly against the law. But a lot of these techniques we see the CIA using, we see the FBI using. So there is certainly some kind of technology sharing and potentially some kind of data sharing, right? We know the FBI will often do the NSA's dirty work in the U.S. A lot of company denials have been saying, you know, we don't work with the NSA. Well, they might not. They might work with the FBI on behalf of the NSA, possibly even secretly, that the company doesn't know that the FBI is working on the NSA's behalf. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the government surveillance, and it's very hard to pick out exactly who does what to whom. Right? Same thing abroad. The government of Belgium has been complaining about NSA surveillance. The government of Germany has. Both of those are NSA partners surveilling on other people. Right? The government of France complains about NSA surveillance. The government of France has its own surveillance. UK and the United States are strong partners, each doing what the other's law prohibits. U.S. and Canada also. Remember recently, the Canadian equivalent to the NSA was found in violation of the law, because what it would do is it would say to the NSA, we're not allowed to do this sort of spying. Can you do it for us?
Well, another thing that you talk about in the article is how this, and this is sort of the subtle thing that doesn't get mentioned that much in a way, where everybody gets bogged down in all the technical details of the different stories and that kind of stuff, is that this is all about a fundamental change in the relationship between the individual and the state that nobody ever got a chance to vote on and say that they were willing to have, you know?
And I think that's
much harder
deal
to take it back once, you know, you found out it's gone this far.
Yeah, and that's very important. And while we can talk about individual programs, I mean, right now there's a bill in Congress to prohibit bulk collection of cell phone call data. But that's just one particular program. And we're learning from the Snowden documents that the NSA has many different programs to get the same data using many different legal authorities. And going after this piecemeal is just not going to work. And yet, we need a fundamental discussion in our society of where the lines are, what is private and what isn't. Right? The conceit is that this stuff keeps us safe. But that has not been demonstrated at all. I mean, all the evidence shows it is a complete waste of money. But we really don't have these sorts of discussions, and these things have sort of come upon us when we weren't paying attention. And some of it's our own doing. Right? You know, Google knows more about what you think than anybody else, because as soon as you think of something, you go on Google and you ask it. Yep. Right? Your cell phone company knows exactly where you've been every minute of the past some number of years, because you've always got that phone in your pocket, and that phone is a tracking device. So we are all leaving these digital footprints as we go through our lives. Right? Our friends are on Facebook, our business is on Gmail, or our cell phone, commerce is all online now using credit cards. So what used to be anonymous is now being recorded. So there's a lot of corporations who have this data, and the government's just getting itself a copy.
Right. All right, now, I guess very quickly, last question here before the break kicks in. Bruce, what do you think is the best avenue for pushing back?
Well, there are two parallel avenues. There's a technical avenue and there's a legal avenue. Technically, there's a lot we can do to make surveillance harder, to re-secure the Internet. And it's real important that the techies start doing that, and they are. The second is legal, that we have to rein in the NSA, other countries. I mean, this is not an easy problem. It's like any kind of arms negotiation or nuclear weapons treaty. We have to be able to come up with international norms and ways to enforce them against bad actors. But we need to recognize, first and foremost, that a secure Internet is in everybody's best interest. Right. And a vulnerable Internet is in everybody's not best interest.
All right, everybody. That is computer security expert Bruce Schneier. He's a correspondent now writing at The Atlantic. The latest is how the NSA threatens national security. Thanks very much.
My parents raised me tenderly. I was their only one. My mind got mixed with rambling when I was all out. I left my home the first time when I was 12 and one. And I'm a long time in a coming more, I'll be a long time gone. I remember when I was rambling around the carnival trains. Different towns, different people, somehow they're all the same. I remember children's faces best, I remember traveling on. And I'm a long time in a coming, I'll be a long time gone. Many times by the highway side I tried the flag arrive. With bloodshot eyes and gritting teeth I watched the cars roll by. I banged my head against the wind and shouted at a stone. And I'm a long time in a coming, and I'll be a long time gone. You might see me on your crossroads when I am passing through. Remember me how you wish to as I'm drifting from your view. I ain't got time to think about it, I got too much to get done. Well, I'm a long time in a coming, and I'll be a long time gone. If I can't help somebody with a word or a song, if I can't show somebody they are traveling wrong, but I know I ain't no prophet, and I ain't no prophet's son. I'm just a long time in a coming, and I'll be a long time gone. So you can have your beauty, it's skin deep and it only lies. And you can have your youth, it rots before your eyes. Just give to me my gravestone with it clearly carved upon. And that's a long time in a coming, and I'll be a long time gone. My parents raised me tenderly, I was their only one. My mind got mixed with rambling when I was all so young. I left my home the first time when I was 12 and one. And I'm a long time in a coming more, and I'll be a long time gone. I'm a long time in a coming more, and I'll be a long time gone.
Last song. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You've been a true delight.
Virgil Caine is my name, and I drove on the Danville train. The Stonewall's cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. I took the train. The time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were singing. They went my wife in Tennessee, and one day she said to me, Virgil, quick, come see, there goes the Robert E. Lee. Now I don't mind them chopping wood, and I don't care if the money's no good.
That's all, folks.